Welcome to this podcast from the Idealized Science Institute. With me is Brian Amorgo, a PhD in science education from University of Pittsburgh and an educator with over 30 years of experience in the classroom. I am Jacob Becky. I'm a PhD candidate at University of Colorado Boulder in theoretical physics and an aspiring educator. And Amorgo and I created the Idealized Science Institute last year in an effort to help students and teachers engage in authentic scientific practices in the classroom. And so today we're going to introduce you to the organization, some of the things that we're going to be building out in the coming years, and also just start to define basic terms that we'll be using in all of our educational materials. So welcome, Amorgo. How's it going?
Nice to see you, Mr. Becky. Looking forward to it. We've been collaborating now for probably upwards of what, like 10 years now?
Yeah. So I had you in intro physics in, I think it was 2013. So nearly 10 years of studying and working together. And we've talked about this for now a number of years, wanting to do something sort of to bring your educational expertise to, you know, teachers that may or may not have had the opportunity to study under someone that is as passionate and excited about physics. So this is that effort. So maybe just to jump in, we should define what idealized science is and how it blends several decades of educational research.
You know, when you talk about idealized science, one of the ways to think of it is it's an opportunity. And that might sound like an odd definition, but it really is the one time, you know, we're normally targeting around the high school level. It's the one time where you could really be scientific. And what I mean by that is, if you're in middle school or high school, undergrad, and even graduate school, and sometimes professional scientists, and you just ask, what is science and what do scientists do? You typically get this distilled definition, you know, often something about the scientific method and as if there is one method. And, you know, it's just not really the case if you have a geologist versus a biologist or a theoretical physicist or cosmologist or whatever it might happen to be. They're all doing different things. The one thing they do have in common, and most don't bring up, is that it's often messy. It's not this linear, perfect sequence of following some method and out pops some kind of truth. So what's ideal about what we're trying to do is we're allowing students to really, as they're learning science, get all aspects of science. And what I mean by that is, you know, there's a social dimension to science, peer review and brainstorming together and things of that nature. There's philosophical ideas like, why should we have confidence in these various methods? And why is this better than other methods? And of course, there's, you know, how do scientists go about doing their work? How do they inquiry, right, into questions that they don't know about? So all of these pieces, it's almost, I mean, it's so rare, it almost never happens that you're in charge of all of these things. Even professional scientists often will take a piece of a project and then with these cognitively distributed systems that we have, pass it off to someone else and someone might analyze it. In a high school, a teacher might give you a sheet and you follow directions and so on. So what we're talking about with idealized science is you're engaged as you're learning and essentially being involved in every aspect of what makes science science, with very little consequences. As a professional scientist, you need to make sure that you're getting particular products made at university, that you're writing lab reports that a particular professor wants. So the ideal part of that is that you're really getting all the aspects of science that, I don't know, it just doesn't seem like you would get otherwise. So
to be concrete here, let's take the example of what I think is probably one of the most common examples of sort of cookie cutter labs that people are used to in high school, middle school, and high school physics, chemistry, right? You have these experiments where you're told what to weigh out. You know, you mix things in exact proportions, you apply a certain amount of heat or some other procedure, and you, you know, verify that some reaction takes place. And obviously with things like chemistry, where, you know, you could be severely injured if you do things incorrectly, it's important to develop these skills of you know, being exact with everything and confirming that things work. But this doesn't really capture the true nature of science. And so a lot of people that go through these sorts of experiments, and the same is true, that it's not just chemistry that's at fault, of course. There's also physics labs, you know, where you're going to, say, confirm the conservation of momentum with, you know, colliding carts on like an air track. There's minimal value to just confirming what you see mathematically, right? What we're getting at with idealized science is actually having students from the conception of from the conception of a claim to you know, making a claim, asking a question, making a claim, building an apparatus, right? And as you say, like all these things in the classroom, you can actually achieve these things, because as long as they're new to the students, they can be vehicles for this kind of understanding, this kind of authentic experience. This is not ever possible in real science, right? Experimentalists, PhD students in experimental physics, spend, you know, 3, 4, 5 years making an experiment work. There's no way that you could go from the conception of that through many iterations of creating it and then interpreting the results as a single person in today's like modern physics. But in the classroom, you absolutely can. And so with very simple experimental settings, you can actually get experience with the full breadth of the scientific endeavor. And that's that is how I interpret the goal of idealized science. And this is how you ran your courses. So I think, you know, I can anecdotally say that it was extremely effective. There's a bunch of research. Part of the podcast, one of our missions is in this podcast to break down research articles for educators and give simple, distillable, and implementable outcomes. So, for example, maybe you could just talk about your experience with active engagement, getting students actively engaged, and also some of the research surrounding these benefits, and really with an emphasis on how teachers can use this in the classroom.
Yeah, one of the things that I wanted to pick up on with the chemistry lab, a lot of times when people think of science, especially school science, they think of data collection. Like, it just feels like you're doing science. Like, look, I mix two things together. I'm writing things down. Look, I'm gonna time it. I'm gonna write some, and it gives a feel of like doing the science, right? Like, look at me. But really, that's like really low level parts of science. The hard part is how do you design that lab, and what theoretical framework are you working in, and then what are the results going to tell you? What are you expecting, and what's going to happen if you get something else? That's the real work of science, and there's very little of that is done. So yeah, that's what we want to do. We want to talk to students about, look, if you wanted to verify this, how would you come about setting this up? And I think you could do it with chemistry. I mean, in physics, we do it with electricity, and there are safe ways to do this because we're not emphasizing just the raw data collection. So yeah, but anyhow, back to your question. Well, I have one more other thing that I have to say, and you're going to try and keep me on task here. But the theoretical frameworks that are often in the educational literature are so rarely read, and many of them are absolutely outstanding. And sometimes scientists themselves don't really give enough credence to the pedagogy and the educational research that's out there. And it's a shame, because there's a lot of educational papers that you read and you think, this is just fantastic on how they're kind of showing us different ways of interacting with students. So I think that's going to be an extraordinary thing that we can contribute with this podcast, is taking some of these papers that are really transformative and helping other people understand them, because I think people will be surprised at how wonderful some of these papers are. So I fully agree with what you were saying there.
And some of the, I think there's a barrier to entry in research. Certainly this is one of the main sort of realizations I've had moving through the PhD is when I started to feel like an expert is when I started to feel comfortable exploring the literature on my own and forming a picture of the relevant pieces. You know, that's kind of one of the most useful skills is you hear a new problem, you don't know anything about it. And as you go through things, it's, you know, you become more and more expert. Everything's connected. So it's, you know, you start to see the connections. And then as you become more expert, you know the literature, you know the seminal works and the relevant things that are most likely to help you. And you also know how to spot a paper that is maybe, you know, not something worth your time. And so these techniques for physics education researchers, some of the things we want to communicate in addition to the content itself, but like summarizing these really seminal results that influence the sort of modern state of practice.
And lowering that barrier, because you don't have to be an expert. I mean, the thing about science is you don't know the answer yet. So you don't have to be an expert. Science is messy because even experts around other experts whose field might be slightly tangent to theirs, suddenly like, yep, that's the expert. So part of the ideal part also is bring people in and let them know whatever level you're at, we can always go a little bit higher. So that comfort exactly. level, right? Super important. So so we'll be directing this at teachers, teacher educators, the general population, and students. You know, I think that's one of the things that we forget too, is the next generation of educators are students now. And, you know, exactly. to be a really good learner, it also helps to be a really good teacher. So why not just expose students to this? I mean, that's what we do anyhow as we're going through this. And so it's yep. like a synergistic effect. So wherever you are, we want to make this comfortable for everyone. We'll also show you some ways of doing these things. That's what one of our goals is, to actually provide some lessons. And even if you can't pull them off right now or you don't want to, you at least have an exemplar of, oh, here's one way that you could approach things. Maybe we're not going to do it that way, but some, you know, originality in there. So it should be exciting.
Exactly. Yeah. So maybe now's a good time to talk about the Idealized Science Institute, the nonprofit that we've started roughly a year ago now, and have started to build out material for and sort of the infrastructure that makes it run. We got a lot of exciting things planned ahead, but maybe let's start by just saying, you know, in addition to this podcast, which we'll start rolling out, we're going to be creating educational materials targeted, I'd say, at teachers. But like you say, totally reasonable that students could absorb this material as well. I think it'd be very beneficial. And so let's start with quick quizzes and just talk a little bit about what they are and how you've developed them and implemented them in your class over the past 30 years.
It might help to give a little bit of a background of me as a student. I just wasn't a very good student. And I just remember thinking, you know, a good portion of the day in school was not very, I don't know, back in when I was younger, I might not have felt that it was terribly worthwhile. But of course, schooling is. But I always just thought there's a way to do this, to be information, you know, get the information across, whatever it is, while there's enjoyment, while there's that thing that pulls you in. And that's what the quick quizzes really are about. It's if you've ever done any kind of work, and it doesn't matter what field it is, and something unique happens and you think, whoa, what was that? It doesn't matter if you're maybe not that interested in music or in English, there's something unique that happened there. And when you're learning that Absolutely. Together, right, that spark. And so that's what these quick quizzes try to do. I just think of myself as a student, and I think, what would it have been like to be in the classroom? And then suddenly you have this question or demonstration, whatever might happen to be, that just you're like, oh, I gotta answer this. I think I know the answer.
Right.
And then right. it doesn't matter if you're right or wrong. It's about, okay, if you really think this, because everyone will say, of course I knew that was going to happen. We encourage you, no, write it down. Write it down and write down as fully as you can what's already going on in your mind. And then the other big piece is list your confidence, right? Because it's easy to say, oh, well, yeah, I didn't mean that. I was just, no, list. How confident are you?
Right.
You really have skin in the game. Now, one of the things that you have to make sure that you do is make sure the students understand this is This is about, you know, the enjoyment of learning. And it's okay if you really thought that this was true, and then you find out it's something else. That can still be celebrated. So it shouldn't be I'm a right or a wrong. It's about the engagement. Right. And then often what this leads to is students say, look, you're saying this is going to happen. I'm saying this is going to happen. There's only one way to find out. And then the students start on their own, naturally, you know, this is that authenticity, right? While it's planned in the background, right? We know students are going to do this. They'll say, wait, why don't we actually go back and do this? We have a little bit of room back right there. We have some supplies, which might happen to just be out that correspond with that right quiz. But then they're like, look, all we have to do to test this and that. And so now you get the students really thinking about experimental design and what results you might expect. And boy, that brings in students that often are quiet during class. And if it's done correctly, it has this wonderful synergy where the whole class is involved. And it doesn't matter if you're right or wrong. Yeah, kids will cheer like, oh, I knew it. But it doesn't matter. And
right. And
after that, you have everyone has a common experience to build on. And then from there, you can really dive in. Right. Yeah.
I remember the sort of surprise and shock of this experience for the first time, because I was honestly, there was a resistance at the start of like, you know, what is this? I don't want to, you know, I certainly felt a little uncomfortable. I was like, you know, this is not what I'm used to in school. But I immediately saw the value. And so this would have been, you know, 10th or 11th grade, I forget, 2013. And then you start to, I started to really like look forward to these quizzes, because I was like, okay, this is going to be fun because we're all going to get to discuss this as a class. And you always fostered, I think it's an important thing, like the zeroth order thing that people need to do in the classroom for these to work well is to foster like an inclusive and supportive environment so everyone feels that they can speak without being judged. Obviously, this isn't how it always works in science, but this is what everyone strives for. And you hope that, you know, as things progress, it will continue to become more and more inclusive for everyone.
That's part of that idea.
In the classroom,
that's part of that ideal part, right? Is in schools, right. You're often taught the only time that you should speak is if you already knew the answer. And it's like, no.
Right.
Like, as a scientist, well, I'm sure you realize, oh, I'm wrong most of the time. It's when I'm
most of the time
when I get when I happen to, when everything aligns and I happen to get something right. That's a rare thing. So, you know, it's important right. To train if we're talking about helping young scientists get that attitude. Look, it's okay to be wrong. Being wrong and then learning from that gets you closer and closer and maybe further away from being really wrong. You get closer and closer to being
right. More
correct. So I didn't mean to cut you off.
No. The unfortunate thing, or both fortunate and unfortunate with this podcast, is we're both so excited about all of these aspects and everything you said. There were each one we could go and start discussing. So it's just a natural thing. No worries at all. But my point with the quick quizzes, and maybe it's worth saying that this is obviously not a completely unique idea that has not existed in the literature. We know that this works. We know that active engagement with students works. Leads to higher learning outcomes. Obviously, you have to, and we will talk about various ways of actually measuring what it means for, you know, students to learn. What does it mean? What do we care about when we're grading them, when we're assessing them, and how do we actually accurately measure growth? But for appropriate measures of student growth, active engagement works. There are these, you know, different renditions on the same theme of quick quizzes. But the point is, what we hope to do is make it as simple as possible. So if you want to talk about conservation of momentum, you go to our website or to our YouTube channel, you find the conservation of momentum quick quizzes, you pick one that you can easily implement with the resources at your disposal, and you see what each one does. What you do in each video is you introduce the quiz. And so this is the point where you're starting to set things up. And as you get better and better, you start to weave it into the bigger story that you're surrounding in that given lecture. You talk about common preconceptions or preconceived notions that students have, often incorrect or not perfect, and that's totally fine. As you said, you meet the students where they are and you bring them further along. And this is also where other students come in. If they have more confidence, you let them discuss with partners, and you pair them up, and so they're able to help each other. This is like the idea of peer instruction. And then in each quick quiz, you demonstrate actually how to implement it, and you see what happens, and then you give an in-depth explanation. And so in principle, a teacher could not really have any background in this, could go to the website or the YouTube and could implement this the next day. That's our hope. That's what we're striving to do. And I hope that this is will end up being useful for instructors for sure. I know if I was going to teach, I would want to use these to start fostering dialogue, to let students really engage in authentic science practices in the classroom. Trying to make that as easy as possible for teachers is the goal. Would you agree with all that?
Yeah, it's important that you're not intimidated by trying these. Even if you just have to make it into a demonstration at first, just to get your feet wet, gain a little confidence as a teacher. But you don't want to just have them as demonstrations. The research is pretty clear. If you just do a demonstration, easy in, easy out, right? What we're really looking for is look, kids come in, teachers come in with preconceived notions. They have prior knowledge. And that's in there, and it's rather robust. It's served them well for most of their lives. So what we're really asking is you have to be willing to rewire your brain a little bit. So you have to be open and say, okay, this is what I'm saying. I'm really confident about this. And if it's true, we're going to put it to a test. If something else happens, I need to at least really think deeply about what was going on there. And do I need to, you know, reconfigure how my wiring is about that particular subject or schemes? And that's crucial, because one of the things that scientists must do is they must follow what the data is saying, right? I mean, no matter how much we want something to be a particular way, in the end, we need to say, okay, there's enough data accumulating in this particular, you know, way of understanding that it's really outweighing maybe the way that I like to think about it. That's so healthy. But think about how rare that is in our everyday thinking. We're not taught that it's okay to change your mind. And now, at the same time, you know, you don't want to be swayed by a magician. A magician can make a card disappear in front of you. And you still have to understand that card somewhere, it didn't go out of the universe. So having the appropriate skepticism. But maybe that's a good analogy in itself. We know magic isn't real, but you really want to know how that happened. And by the way, if it's magic, just let it go and just enjoy that they did that. But in science, you know, it's fine to, no, we're going to really find out what this is. And think about it. I mean, people pay a lot of money to go to a magician. So as a teacher, if you can't quite pull it off yet, do it as a demonstration. The nice thing about teaching is every year you hope to get a little bit better. And if you have a 30-year career, imagine where you'll be at by your third year. Fifth year, you'll be a master.
I mean, the same advice that I would provide to any student that I'm mentoring is the same advice that applies to teaching. Is, you know, you get a little bit better each time, and you integrate that over a long enough time, and you're masterful at whatever you do. And this obviously holds in general, but with the quick quizzes, I agree that certainly I wouldn't. For instance, with electricity and magnetism, I never deeply learned it the way I learned mechanics from you. Because you didn't have an electricity and magnetism course when I was going through, you know, when I was in high school. So that happened after I graduated. So I had the experience that many others have. Even if I had decent lecturers, they didn't themselves deeply understand anything past the mathematics in many cases. So what I was getting was a presentation of the material in common textbooks. Standard problems that everyone, you know, the professors were competent enough to work through, but there was not any sense that I was, you know, getting some fundamental deep understanding of the nature of electricity and magnetism. So I wouldn't feel comfortable implementing all of the quick quizzes, especially the complex ones that you've created on E&M. But I do feel that through the materials you're creating, I would over time be able to implement them by watching more in the instructions that are given, as well as the understanding that I can gain from watching them. I would feel comfortable over time implementing them. And I think that is the hope for all teachers watching these.
We are hoping that this is in our strategic plan that we're currently working on is, you know, and this was an idea that you had. Couldn't we send out a box of materials for teachers to work with that are safe enough? Look, we might give a teacher a steel ball for a momentum problem. You could certainly hurt yourself with that, but there are ways with electricity that we could, you know, ensure the safety and as they develop, you know, so, you know,
but even not safety concerns. So safety concerns are obviously a huge issue, but just the deep understanding of some of these more complicated, things, I think, you know, if you don't feel, let's say you're shaky on a topic, you're going into the classroom, it's your first year as a teacher.
Oh,
chances are good you're not going to feel comfortable engaging and fostering, you know, engaging students in dialogue and fostering that conversation and having it weave to where you want to go. You know, that is an advanced maneuver, and it's a learned skill. And so the goal of the Quick Quiz is, among other things in the Idealized Science Institute, are to help teachers acquire those skills over time. And in regards to the boxes, so this is another planned, you know, offering of the Institute is, you know, you mentioned you give this Quick Quiz, and I know how the students are. I was one of them at one point. You know, they can only talk so much. Eventually, they're just itching to start building something. And once they know that they can answer these problems through experimentation, they want to get back to the labs. But the crucial, you know, thing to distinguish here is that although Freedom High School, where you know where you teach and where I graduated from, although it's not a rich district by any means, it does have this studio classroom setup where you have sort of a lecture hall type front of the room where you have chalkboards, you have projectors, and then the back half of the room is a studio, you know, laboratory environment. And not all schools have that luxury. And so one of the things we want to do is basically have a studio in a box, a studio classroom that you can, simple things, simple apparatus that can be built and set on a student's desk. So that's something that we will be building out.
Yeah. It's my opinion that if you're in a barn, you teach in a barn. Whatever you have, by the way, if you're in a barn, you probably have some really neat mechanical stuff. Whatever you have around you, trying to gain that confidence.
Right.
The one thing that I will say, which is so odd in our profession, is that your first day as a teacher, you're expected to be good. I mean,
right.
I mean, how is that possible? It's just not. So look, if you're a young teacher, don't put that pressure on yourself. Understand, to gain expertise, I have about 30 years now, 29 or something like that. So, you know, it took I had a long time to develop and get better and better each year. So wherever you are, it's absolutely fine. And by the way, I think most students will understand that more than society. I think students will say, oh, they're a first year teacher, cut them some slack. But I guarantee they will be on your side if you're showing, look, I'm in here with you guys, I'm enjoying this with you, and I don't know everything, but we're going to be able to move forward. And as things come up, we'll figure it out, you know, so...
Exactly. I think that's also just being honest and open with the students on your shortcomings. I mean, in contrast to your, you know, many years of experience, I've only ever taught two courses formally. And in both cases, you know, it was just a learn as you go. And the students, you think that the students are going to be extremely critical of all your missteps and stuff. But with planning and openness, and also, like you said, just the acceptance that we don't know everything. We don't know everything in science. We don't know everything in the classroom. And we're going to figure it out together. I think that shifts the agency from, you know, just me telling them facts and them, you know, regurgitating them on a test, to now we're figuring out these problems together. And I'm here to help guide them to some new understanding, meet them where they are and take them as far as we can. So this is the general trend, I think, of our sort of teaching philosophy. And, the Idealized Science Institute, there are many other aspects of it, including and sort of the most ambitious, I would say, is a hope that eventually science conferences at the high school level will be sort of a standard practice. So maybe, you know, I know that we could talk about so many of these aspects for a really long time, but maybe for brevity's sake, we should talk a little bit about the science conference and how it sort of embodies really the essence of Idealized Science. And then, you know, we can conclude and save, you know, these many interesting conversations for dedicated episodes on the topics.
The things that you mentioned earlier today is look, these ideas are not brand new. I mean, go back 150 years ago, go back to John Dewey, if you will. they're saying the same things. The next generation science standards came out. It's almost 15 years ago now, like 10 years, 11, whatever it is, right. For the new standards framework. And they're begging teachers to do this, begging. And that's right. Nothing new. You go back to 96 and 93 and the other documents. It's easier said than done. And so one of the primary ways that we think the real change agent could be is, look, science is essentially about coming up with new things and getting it peer-reviewed, taking all that work, and then you go to a conference and you say, here's what I have to offer. I might have built on these other ideas, but no one's gone further. Here's what I got. Instead of having science fairs where, you know, let's face it, people type in what's a good science fair and people do the volcano or whatever it is, we already know what it's going to do. There's very little learning that can be done there. I mean, some people will go further, but in general, it's more of like a show.
Well, and even maybe if I can just interject there quickly, like obviously science fairs can become more sophisticated as students get further into science, but like fundamentally and a priori, they don't guarantee that authentic science will take place. Maybe that's a fair general statement that can be made.
Yeah.
Because there's probably value to even, you know, maybe it's an engineering or robotics type project. Right. It's not really science, but it's still really valuable if it's getting students engaged. But what we're talking about is something fairly distinct from that. Sorry to interject, but I just want to clarify.
No, I think it's perfect that you're putting that in there because, of course, there can be value. But think about doing something like a small science conference at your school where only original research is allowed. In other words, like an easy motto to use is, if you can Google it, why are you doing it? If the answer is already no.
Right.
And people think, well, everything that's ever been done has been done and I'll never think of anything. I guarantee you watch a kid and they're doodling. They have a roll of tape in their hand, flinging around in their finger. That's their long-term. Like, how does the radius affect the period of it, right? And they'll be like, I already know it's going to go faster because it gets bigger, goes faster. And then you simply ask them, well, how do you know that? And then they're like, well, I just know.
Right.
Well, do you have any data for that? No. Well, then they can collect that data. And by the way,
the simplest possible questions can lead to really interesting investigations.
And then once they start doing this, they might say, well, my finger gets tired. I'm going to put this on a pole. They start swinging it on a pole. And then you realize there's other crazy effects that happen that you would never predict. And then you're like, oh, that's the thing that I really want to do. Look what it's doing there.
Yep.
Why is it doing that? And now you're motivated. The hard thing is just getting started. But we do that.
Absolutely.
We do this every year with all of our students, from the students that struggle the most to our top students. Every student has to, that's taking physical science or physics or physics 2, physics 3, whatever it is, they have to do.
And even sixth graders.
Yeah, and sixth graders. Worth mentioning. Right? And you got to work with them at first and show them that this is a like a safer space and you don't have to get an answer that is, quote, correct. You just engage and you let people know what you're doing. And then everyone presents at a science conference. And then everyone can critique. And at the end, you have questions. By the way, you do a lot of that questioning through iterations as you're developing. But it is just magical. And the big thing is, it's transformative. Think of how many students go through typical science classes, just taking a test. And then they want to become a professional scientist and go for their advanced degree. And then suddenly it's like, wait, you're not going to tell me what to do now? I have to.
Right.
And then what? Their whole conception of science is working on problems out of a textbook or taking a test. And it's like, no, that was just kind of school science. So it really is maybe the way to help everyone, including administrators, parents, students, teachers, teacher educators. If you say, why not try a science conference? It forces you to do with the next generation science standards. And by the way, we have new standards coming out. They're all saying the same thing. Try to engage students in practices that scientists actually engage. So,
And a few points. So first off, it is an incredibly difficult thing. I remember when you were first organizing the first conference. So this was maybe 7 or 8 years ago. how stressful it was to schedule everything, all of these factors and stuff, but you are doing it almost independently. And you could imagine other districts where there's more support from other educators and from administrators to make it a more feasible, you know, sort of the administrative side of things, make that easier by distributing it across those participating. But even though it is such a, you know, incredible effort that needs to take place, it is hard. It's like palpable when you're there how excited everyone is. Even students that don't really like, haven't enjoyed science or don't view themselves as scientists, I think when they go up there and talk and people ask, you know, no one's there to, you foster a welcoming environment. No one's there to ask really critical questions, critical in the sense of like, you know, targeted and mean. Of course, you're critical in your line of questioning in the sense that you want to understand how they did their investigation, what they found, the limitations. And you see, you can almost see the change visually happen in students, and it's pretty remarkable. And I think that it's, you know, this is one of the, let's say, highest barrier to entry change agents, whereas quick quizzes, I really believe, are implementable by first year educators immediately. And all of these are aspects of the Idealized Science Institute.
And one of the other things is we have, you know, you come back nearly every year at the science conference, you present alongside with them. We have sixth graders doing it and they're all mixed together. There's no like, oh, you know, we're ranking you on who did the best. Everyone appreciates what you've done. And that's because they've all done a long term. And this is so empowering. Anyone who's ever done a long term suddenly can pick out who has never actually done real science in their life. Because, boy, right, everything's so easy. All you have to
do one of them.
And then you realize, right, oh my gosh, there's so many decisions. And every one of those I have to justify. So you can pick out everyone who's ever done a real long term. And you don't even have to do a science conference if you don't want. Just begin doing long term projects. It is amazing how it transforms people and students from school science people to more authentic scientists, right?
Absolutely.
And
obviously, the hope is that someday there won't be a distinction between school science and authentic science, of course. But yeah, it's pretty remarkable to see. And
there's a lot of pressure on teachers to get through the chapters of the book. There's a lot of pressure to get, you know, if you have a state test or something like that, to score really high. Unfortunately, many of these areas, which, by the way, we're begging, you know, science educators are begging teachers, please hit these science and engineering practices. Please take time to talk about the epistemological underpinnings of why students are doing this. But school can be very hard on teachers where they feel it's just about content. And so hopefully this will give a little bit of an opening for teachers to say, look, you know, this is what our standards are really asking us to do. You know, if you look at the standards, only 1/3 of the next generation science standards really are focused on content. About 1/3 of what we're asking is practices, and 1/3 is about finding patterns and ideas. So, you know, it's what we really should be doing. But again, teachers feel a lot of pressure.
Right. And I think that there's certainly pressure for, you know, underserved districts Freedom, where, you know, if these students don't get to do well on the AP exam, then that means they're going to be spending more money that they don't have at the college level. So there's all these pressures and stuff. But all of these we need to dig into in more detail. But the general takeaway is that the mission with the nonprofit is to facilitate this active and authentic engagement in science, and we're going to be doing this in a number of ways.
But one of the outcomes that we see is we see how many of our students that are doing these long term projects end up going into science and engineering, and doing really well because they just have a totally different mindset now, right? It's almost like they can see beyond now, and they're like, oh, I see the big picture, you know. And I think you can almost feel it's just a different atmosphere when you talk to them. They have a bigger picture, and it's certainly more enjoyable for everyone. So I think that's
totally.
I think if teachers will get out of their comfort zone and try these little, don't get in over your head, and we'll be there to help you, but just try it. You'll see that, yeah, often it's a bit more work, but the reward is, you know, it's the prize, right? That everyone, you look around and everyone's enjoying what they're doing. So, yeah.
Absolutely. And I think a testament to the success of all this is that you have alumni, yeah, spanning 20 years, 25 years, that still return to high school to meet with other alumni and also to talk to students. And so everyone is excited to come back for a reason. And yeah, so, you know, there's just so many benefits to this sort of
style. And it's not just a few. I mean, what do we have? 20 alumni that come back, new alumni every year, roughly about 20.
Mm-hmm.
I think, and it's so funny because, you know, you talk to other people and they're like, you're going back to your high school? And they're like, yeah, you don't understand, right? It's just what we do. It's, you know, like it's, you kind of build this community and you're always part of it. So it's a wonderful, absolutely, environment for the community. Yeah.
Exactly. Yep. Awesome. All right, Wargo. Well, thank you. As usual, I look forward to the rest of our conversations on these topics. Yeah. And yeah, I'm just really genuinely excited about where the nonprofit is headed. And I hope that we start to reach new people and that the content is immediately useful to them.
We have a good team with us at the Idealized Science Institute, and we're hoping to make a difference, and we're rolling it out a little bit slowly, but that's where we're going. It's thinking into the future and where we hope to be in a few years. So
absolutely. Yeah. Awesome. Well, I'll see you in the next one.
All right. Nice talking to you as always.